everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and a great big speculative fiction nerd. So, I've got to welcome you all back to our Andy Weir double feature here. And this week, it was my choice. He only has two movies out there, so we've pretty much covered it now, I think. And I picked Project Hail Mary, which at the time of recording is something that is still in theaters. So this movie tells the thrilling story of Ryland Grace, an anxious and unwilling middle school teacher who just happens to save the Earth anyway from an astrophage that is dimming our sun and all the other stars nearby.
Are they eating the sun?
They seem to be dimming the sun a tiny, teeny, weeny little bit.
So no big one.
It's a small one. It's a small to medium whoop. Over the next 30 years, the Earth could cool maybe 10 to 15 degrees.
All the nations of the world band together to confront this catastrophe. Grace discovers that a microbe is responsible and then becomes part of the crew that heads out on an 11 light year journey to Tau Ceti, the only star that seems strangely resistant to this astrophage. When the other crew members are killed by the long coma that the journey requires, Grace is left all alone. Well, that is, besides his new best friend, Rocky, an alien from 40 Eridani. Together, they must solve the riddle and save their stars. So, Catherine, tell me a little bit about your experience with this film.
Well, I saw it on March 20th when it came out. Took my lab members, my graduate students, to see it. One of them was very excited. She had read the book and was keen to see it on screen. I brought my daughter with me too. So yeah, we all had a pretty good time. I didn't take any notes. I just watched it. I wanted to kind of take it all in. When I got home, I furiously wrote some stuff down. I had already read the book too, which helped. I read it probably about a year after it came out. I was going through all like the Hugo nominees for that year and was looking for something to read and had read The Martian. So I tried this one. I recently reread it too, because I'd basically forgotten a lot of it in the subsequent 5 years. And I gotta say, when I first read it, I was not super impressed. I think I commented on this with The Martian too. It's so math heavy. It just struck me like this first year physics test. And I was a little unimpressed. And I found somebody on Blue Sky who kind of summed it up in a way that better than I could. And she said, it's a novel with nothing to say, no decent prose to say it with, no notable characters who might say it, but quite a lot of math.
So,
Yeah. It's the quite a lot of math, right? And the limited character growth that, like The Martian, really bothers me about Andy Weir's stuff. So I was excited to see this on the big screen because I figured someone like Ryan Gosling would do a great job. And I was really pleased to see how well they did with Rocky too. I think they did a great job with those two in a way that does not come across as well in the book.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Like the directors and the actors go a long way towards humanizing the characters. And I think, as we'll see when we get into the science gripes in a minute, even though Andy Weir is very focused on math and problem solving, you know, famously from the last episode we did, you know, life is just, you know, solving one problem and then the next problem and so forth. Even though he is focused on the math like that, he certainly isn't afraid to fudge his numbers when the story requires it.
Yeah.
We definitely have uncovered, and he himself is aware of places where, you know, he needs a MacGuffin. And oh, that hurts a little bit.
I do feel like there's more fudging in Project Hail Mary than in The Martian. I think he was trying to stick a little bit more closely to the truth in The Martian. So that one was a little bit more realistic. Obviously, they're going to like a different star system and meeting an alien. So, you know, there's some more things you have to work with here. But yeah, I mean, what surprised me, I guess, is that even though I enjoyed the movie more than the book, probably because they left out a lot of that math, it didn't do as good of a job with the science. So a lot of my science gripes are things the movie didn't do or didn't explain very well that were explained in the book, but perhaps over-explained in the book. So I'm not mad at it,
yes.
But I think I have more science gripes with the movie than the book.
Yeah, that's always interesting, I think, with science fiction. How do you package it in such a way that you maintain that audience interest and you really grab people on that emotional level. At the same time, I mean, science fiction movie isn't meant to teach us math problems. I think it's good that they recognize this. So before we jump into the science gripes here, I should probably explain that Catherine and I are going to be coming at this from a little bit of a different level of experience, shall we say? Catherine had that recent reread of the book. She's seen the movie a couple of times. Me, I just went to one screening. I did read the book, but that was, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So my knowledge is a little bit older there. And we were talking just before we got on the air here about how much respect we have for film critics who have to jot down their notes in the dark. Mine are definitely, it's an interesting looking page in my journal, I have to say, after writing it down. I went to an old-timey theater here in Toronto, saw it in glorious 70 millimeter celluloid, you know, no digital projection for me or anything like that. And it was pitch black in there. So a lot of fun, but, you know, fidelity, you know, maybe not so great.
You should take a picture of that and post it. I want to see your scrawled notes taken in the dark.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the science gripes here. So Catherine, what was the thing that bugged you?
Okay, so the thing that I was complaining about as soon as I left the movie theater was their artificial gravity, which is something, again, they dealt with well in the book. So in the book, Project Hail Mary had this weird design where there was this crew cabin that was oriented a certain way when the engines were on, so you could get thrust gravity. But then when they were, you know, in orbit around Tau Ceti, the idea was that, okay, well, we don't want to keep thrusting, we'll leave the solar system. So we're going to flip that crew cabin around, put it on a tether, and then spin it as a centrifuge, which is complicated, but theoretically could work. And I could not figure out what they were doing with this ship in this movie. It seemed like they were rotating the entire ship, not that anything had like broken off and was spinning separately. Although in watching it a second time, they might have tried to do this. I could not make any sense of this ship. But when I first watched it, it looked like the whole ship was just rotating, which would mean that you'd be standing on the ceiling, right? Because if the thrusters are at one end and suddenly you just start rotating it, now you'd be on the ceiling. So I was really bothered by that. And maybe they tried to do it, but if they did, it was very subtle and was not obvious to me how they were trying to make this gravity. And in basically most of the scenes, they have gravity, right? In the book, it's a big deal. They keep turning it on and off again where they need it and where they don't. But I mean, I guess for the practicalities of filming this, they didn't want to bother with all these zero-G scenes. So they mostly just have gravity. I don't know. Could you make that out, John? What did you think of their gravity system?
Well, it is a system I've seen before, at least a variation on it. So they have these tethers, and there's a big chunk of the ship that they cast off a long way from the original ship on these two tethers, and then the two of these two ships essentially spin around each other. And it reminds me of plans that I've seen for Mars missions, where you keep the upper stage of the rocket, and you put that on a long tether, and you go around and round. And it solves the problem that you have with space stations or centrifugal gravity that, you know, the smaller the axis of rotation, the more nauseous you are. Whereas if you have a nice big axis of rotation, like you'd get with a tether, then you would have a much more pleasant, more gravity-like experience. The challenges with this is that you've got some moving parts, you've got connection points there. And it looked like here the tethers were actually deploying through gaps in the rest of the structure.
Yeah.
So the chances that you'd get things all tangled up, I mean, it seems like a dangerous way to set up this spacecraft to be.
Yeah, so I found that whole system confusing. In watching it a second time, maybe they did try to address it, but as John said, it wasn't the same as they did it in the book, and I think it'd be quite dangerous in either case to try to set up gravity. The whole point is they need the gravity to use their lab equipment. Actually, I don't know if they addressed this in the movie. There's a very short scene where they talk about this, and Ryan Gosling talks about centrifuging butter in the Civil War, which is also wrong. As far as I could tell, they didn't invent this till after the Civil War. Anyways, so it's a very short scene. But in the book, the idea is, well, you know, it'd be too complicated to make instruments that work in zero gravity. Let's just make gravity and send the instruments we use on Earth. So each have their complications, but that's what they settled on.
It's interesting. It does remind me of the different engineering aesthetics of the Soviet Union and the Americans during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans designing things for the environment, which is why they look so skeletal, and the Soviets designing things to operate under atmosphere, under these sort of Earth conditions. And that's why they look bulbous, because there are these pressure vessels on their spacecraft.
Yeah, the example I love is that the Americans went to all this trouble to try to figure out how to make a pen that would work in zero gravity. And the Russians are just like, we're going to bring a pencil, you know?
Yes.
So
yes.
Different engineering solutions to the same problem.
Indeed. And what did you think of Gosling sort of bouncing around like a toy? Like, that just takes me back to Miller and Lord's other work. You know, I'm temporarily in the Spider-Verse with Ryan Gosling.
I don't think I noticed it as much as you. What I did notice, though, was that he seemed to be walking on walls. Like, the gravity was not consistent. And I didn't understand that either. Like, at some point, he'd be like walking on a wall and then on the floor and then kind of all over the place. So that didn't make a ton of sense to me either. But I think you're right. It was played for more comedic effect, right? It wasn't meant to be realistic necessarily.
Oh yeah. And like any Andy Weir story, we always need to start off, I think, with some kind of weird MacGuffin. Like,
yes.
You saw that in The Martian with the unrealistic dust storm. And here we start off with the coma.
The coma. Yeah. I always thought you were going to go somewhere else. There's a lot of MacGuffins in this movie.
True. But we'll get to them, dear viewer.
Yeah. But yeah, why did they put them in a coma? I've been pondering this for the past few days, right? It was a four-year trip. So Tau Ceti is a little under 12 light years away from Earth. But if you're traveling close to the speed of light, as we'll talk about later, there's something called time dilation. Relativity explains this. And so that 12-year trip takes about 4 years. So that's all realistic. That's fine. But it's only 4 years. Why do they have to put them in a coma for four years? Right? I was thinking about, well, we had all these transatlantic, or, you know, all these ships that would go around, circumnavigate the world, right? The Voyage of the Beagle, I looked it up. It was 5 years long, right? So that's an example of humans being apart from civilization for long periods of time. Mind you, you're not on a space station, but even then, people have lived on a space station for over a year and they haven't gone crazy. I think that was the idea, right? They would go insane taking 4 years to get to another star system. I just don't buy it, especially given all the dangers of being in an induced coma. Yeah. So John, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, the best I could come up with here is, you know, if you're comatose, then you consume fewer calories. And a lot of these types of ideas in science fiction where they put people into suspended animation is usually to save on resources. But, you know, they had all that extra mass for all of those interesting t-shirts that Ryan Gosling wore.
And the vodka.
So I think Yeah. So I think the real reason here is that Andy Weir needed the other astronauts to die.
Yes. No, I agree. That is why he did it. But it didn't make a ton of sense. And they went through this whole song and dance in the book about certain people being coma resistant. I don't think there's any evidence that backs this up. But even so, 2/3 of them died. So, like, this is not a great technique. I don't know why they, and I know they said nothing about this mission is safe, but still, right? You want at least one person to show up alive at your destination. And I bet you if they didn't put them in a coma, they would have had three people alive at their destination. So yeah, I found this kind of a strange, like you said, MacGuffin. It's a reason for Ryan Gosling to be alone, but it doesn't make a lot of sense when you start to poke at it too much.
Oh yeah, I get you there. It is an efficiency problem in addition to an unfortunate thing that happens, because yeah, if no one's awake when you get there, well, that was all for nothing.
Yeah. But yeah, as far as I could tell, there's no safe way to be in a coma. There's no safe period of time. There's so many risks of being in a coma. And even if you do come out the other end, you're going to need like a long period of time to get your body working again, right? Physically and cognitively, because you've been in a coma for 4 years, right? So, and they needed these astronauts to be on their game right away, investigating this star. So yeah, I thought it was a strange choice.
Well, let's talk about some of the organisms from this movie that did not need to be put in a coma. So let's talk about the astrophage and the weird kind of life that Andy Weir proposes in his book and gets talked about in the movie.
Well, right. This is the MacGuffin I thought you were going to talk about. And even Andy Weir acknowledges this is unrealistic. So astrophage are these organisms that apparently come from Tau Ceti and traveled around the local neighborhood and are starting to destroy stars around them. So they have to both live on the surface of the sun, cool, also in space, also cool, and then in Venus or other atmospheres with CO2. I mean, there's no organisms that we know of that can do all of these things. And there's no organism that we know of that could live on the sun, as they say. So he invents this MacGuffin. I don't think they talk about it in the movie at all, but basically it's some hand-wavy thing about neutrinos. So neutrinos are these tiny, I don't know, what would you call them? It's been a while since I've taken a physics course.
Elementary particles?
Yeah, elementary particles, sure. That basically have no mass and interact very rarely with matter. There's actually a telescope, I think at the South Pole, that uses the entire Earth to slow the neutrinos down so they might have a hope of detecting a few of them. It's called like the Ice Cube Observatory. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah. And don't forget about the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, the Snow Lab.
Yeah. So there's also a neutrino observatory not far from us here in Ontario that uses heavy water, again, in an attempt to try to like slow down these neutrinos so they might interact with matter a little bit. So it uses deuterium and oxygen rather than hydrogen and oxygen. So there's a number of these sort of neutrino observatories around the world, including one in Sudbury. But they're very, very hard to detect. But the idea here is that the neutrinos are inside the astrophage, the cell, and are somehow confined inside the cell, even though they rarely interact with matter otherwise. There's no way you could do that, right? This is a huge MacGuffin. But the idea is the neutrinos would absorb the solar energy, so the cell inside would be fine, because there's no way a cell, even when at 96 degrees, which the astrophage are, would be able to survive the sun, right? The sun is thousands and thousands of degrees. Everything would just get blown to bits. So this was a huge MacGuffin. Like, nothing can live on the sun. Neutrinos don't react with matter in any meaningful way. And then having it go into space and survive that too, the whole thing was just crazy.
True, but it's kind of fun. It's something that I think that science fiction writers in particular have played around with for quite some time, this idea of, you know, life on stars. And I think maybe it's not the most crazy thing, but this is not a particularly sensible way to do it.
Well, and the whole reason they talked to Ryland Grace, Ryan Gosling, is that he'd written a paper about how life could use other solvents other than water for life, which is true, which we'll talk about. But again, none of those solvents would survive on the sun either, right? There's no liquid that survives at thousands of Kelvin. That just doesn't make any sense. So even in the case where it doesn't use water, which astrophage apparently does, it still doesn't work. And as far as we know, life does appear to need a solvent, a liquid that it can interact and perform chemistry in. So I don't know how you'd have life on the sun.
Yeah, at least life as we know it.
Yeah. Well,
but this is a weird hybrid.
Yeah. Good news for us, though. Probably not going to, there's not going to be any astrophage dimming our sun anytime soon.
Unless this is something that evolved very, very recently. It sort of suffers a little bit from something related to what's called like the gray goo problem, in the sense that it's probably pretty hard to stop something like this. And you imagine at the speed of light, it could pretty much spread to the observable universe pretty quickly.
Well, yeah, that was the other thing. I don't know if we want to talk about this here or later, but they talked about how quickly it would breed and how quickly it would dim the sun. But it would just keep going. It would just keep breeding and dimming the sun further and further. And they don't address that. Like, it's not like we have to deal with a 10% dimming of the sun, right? Like, hypothetically, they could just take all the energy from the sun and we would have nothing. And now it's not climate change. Now it's just total solar system apocalypse, right? And they didn't really talk about that either.
The danger of these biological von Neumann machines.
So, and then the third MacGuffin, which I think everyone is aware of, is this weird substance called xenonite that the Eridanians, Rocky and company, used to build basically everything, as far as I can tell. So it's apparently a solid compound that is primarily made of xenon. And this is weird because xenon is what we call a noble gas. So it has all its electron orbitals filled up. It's very happy and stable. It doesn't want to react with anything. And so mostly they're gases. Helium, neon, argon, xenon. These are all what we call noble gases. And typically they're called that because they are typically gases, right? They don't form solids. So the idea that xenon would make a solid was kind of a weird idea. I was surprised to learn, though, that xenon can actually form solids under certain conditions, typically requiring huge pressures or unstable kind of situations. But xenonite still is kind of a weird idea, because the most stable xenon-containing solid I could find was something called xenine difluoride. So that's xenon and then two fluoride molecules. But it doesn't seem to be very stable. It decomposes on contact with water vapor, which surely Grace's ship has. It also apparently smells terrible, which I thought was fun. But although Rocky smells terrible too, because he lives in this ammonia atmosphere. But yeah, like, xenon doesn't typically form solids, and the solids that are formed are not very stable unless you have extreme pressures, which clearly they didn't. So I would call xenonite another MacGuffin in this movie.
Oh, definitely. There's always this desire with these science fiction stories, I think, to imagine some impossible material. And yeah. A lot of the other shows and series that do this sort of thing, they just come up with something that is not really related to anything. You know, it just sounds kind of techy. Whereas here we have something that it'd be very hard to understand how it would create a solid. It's not even like theoretically thought to create a solid with useful properties. So it seems more like maybe we're decided, you know, what's the most implausible thing out there? And I'll make it that.
Yeah. Well, at least with like the core and their unobtainium, like they don't even try to explain it really.
Exactly.
Whereas here he got out the, you know, handheld XRF analyzer to show us that it was xenon. But, you know, I bet the most of the audience like didn't understand why that was weird. It's only the nerds who'd be like, ooh, xenon, you know? So what was the whole point of that? Anyways, I thought that was strange.
Maybe a little something for the nerds.
Well, the whole book is for the nerds, though. I guess they could have explained it a bit better in the movie. Really, it's just him taking out an analyzer, pointing it at the xenonite, and then being like, what the heck, you know? And that was sort of the end of it. And then they just proceed on.
Oh, yeah. Well, moving along the train of implausible and strange things, we've got to talk about Rocky, right?
You know,
the astronauts from Eridani. And you have a lot more of the details here. Because you've got, you recently reread the book, and so you've got those numbers. And I've got to say, I was thinking after watching the movie, you know, that's a fun idea, but it's implausible. And then you gave me the numbers, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's way more implausible than I thought it was.
Oh, yeah? How so? In what way?
Well, just, it seems like, I don't know, like Rocky is more designed than evolved in some ways. Like it's almost if you went out and picked the strangest things you could from the hardware store to create a life form from, like the blood being liquid mercury at 310 degrees. And just, I don't know, there's so much like the basically his muscle is a shape memory alloy from the sound of it, since it's actuated by temperature changes and all this stuff. He's really spry for something that is that small, which made me think about, you know, what could the power source be for this particular organism, especially since, you know, he doesn't like oxygen, which is what powers our fairly spry metabolism. You did a bit of a deep dive into this, I think.
Well, I just read the book.
That counts.
Yeah, so I'm not going to give him too many demerits for Rocky, because honestly, I don't think we're clever enough to understand what alien life looks like. So maybe there are aliens made of oxidized minerals with metallic bones and liquid mercury for blood, you know? Who knows, right? I think using our imaginations to think about aliens is not a bad idea, because I think we're so fixated on how life works on Earth, and we only have one data point. All life on Earth is related to one another. We all have the same biochemistry. We all work kind of the same way. And so I think it's really hard for us to envision other life forms. But in other cases, when we've looked outside the solar system, our assumptions that all solar systems look like ours were wrong, you know, that all stars are like the sun are wrong. It's just, we don't know what we don't know. So I didn't mind that aspect of Rocky being this sort of rock body. What was stranger is that it still uses a lot of the same biochemistry as humans do. Like they specifically mentioned that they still use ATP, which is this molecule that we use for energy in our metabolism, and various other biological organic components. That to me was sort of stranger than the rest of him. But I guess what they're trying to imply is that we all came from Tau Ceti through this sort of panspermia, where life evolved in the Tau Ceti system, the astrophage and the Taumeba, and then they kind of got distributed throughout the universe and formed the Eridanis and the humans on Earth. Why it took so long for then astrophage to come here, I don't know, because, you know, you'd have a time difference of 4 billion years. But I think that was the idea, that we all originated on Tau Ceti and then got distributed throughout the universe, and so we're all related to one another. And so maybe that makes some sense why Rocky and humans use the same biomolecules.
I hadn't quite caught that. So I guess the lineage that comes from Rocky led to automotive engineers, you know, just based on the components. ATP is weird, though, isn't it? Because big revolution in biology, not to get too deep into it on Earth, is that you can make a whole lot more ATP when you move from fermentation to, you know, things with oxygen, you know, aerobic metabolisms, which Rocky can't do. But I will give them, like you say, it does upset sort of some of the preconditions or sort of preconceptions that we have. which is nice. And where my mind went until Catherine pointed this out last weekend was Rocky, silicon-based life, right? And that has a long history, I think. So immediately my mind went there. And it turns out he's simultaneously not as strange as that, but stranger than that in how he's put together.
Yeah, I think you compared him to a crab, right? Like, so he has all his organic stuff kind of like stuffed in the middle of him. And then the rest is just this rocky carapace that acts as like a heat sink to keep him at the right temperature so his weird steam-powered muscles can work. So yeah, like you said, it's both stranger than fiction, but also somewhat realistic. Silicon-based life is this idea that instead of carbon, our biomolecules would use silicon as the primary element. That's a lot harder to do than carbon-based life, but sci-fi loves to talk about it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think a place that we have to go before we finish the science gripes here is something that I think Andy Weir really subscribes to, which makes us a little bit uncomfortable. And I'm talking about the lone genius idea. You know, this idea, and we run into it all the time in science as well. I'm on an awards committee right now where we're trying to pick some lone geniuses. And this idea that science is advanced by these lone geniuses. In the past, it would have been called, you know, like the great man hypothesis as well. And that's not how science works. But this movie is set up to basically put everything on Ryland Grace's shoulders. Yeah,
it doesn't seem plausible. No, and especially
exactly.
Him. And it's not like he's like some Nobel Prize winning chemist working at Stanford or, you know, or something. He's a middle school teacher who like dropped out of grad school essentially because nobody liked his idea. This is not the person you would put in charge of this program, even if you are intent on having one person in charge of it, which is not how science works, right? Science is very collaborative because everyone's got different skills and backgrounds and something to contribute. And so more and more, we see these huge teams of people working on problems, and they're the ones who are getting the major scientific discoveries. It's not just one guy in an office by himself. Honestly, I like science so much more when I get to chat to people, talk to people about it, brainstorm, come up with ideas. You know, I think of things when I go to a meeting or talk to someone that I would never have come up with on my own. So this doesn't make a lot of sense. And then furthermore, you know, he's kind of made out to be this antisocial kind of guy with no friends, and yet he instantly makes friends with an alien, you know, but he can't even work with people back on Earth. I don't know. There's a lot here that I don't love, but as you say, it seems like it's Andy Weir's kind of jam.
Exactly. I thought that psychological part was very strange, you know, that sort of threadable evil. He has to be somebody who's, you know, pleasant and interesting, but yet so weird that humans don't want to associate with him, but also be that sort of lone scientist. And I didn't buy it, right? Like, I've seen people like the way that this is played by Gosling. And in my experience, people with that kind of personality are more popular and more keen to collaborate and, you know, have friendships than he is. So it's hard to really understand what makes his character tick, as much fun as he is to watch.
Yeah, yeah. When I was a physics major, they used to say, because I was a woman, you know, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. And I don't even think he would fall into that category, right? There's a lot of oddballs in science. We all have our hyperfixations here, which is why we become scientists. But Grace seems very much like a normal person, you know. I would not peg him as a strange antisocial scientist from how he acts in this movie.
Absolutely.
And even his idea, right? This, that astrophage is not water-based. There can be life that uses a solvent other than water. It's not like some out there idea that people would give him guff about at a UNESCO conference, which, by the way, is not a meeting that scientists go to. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty kind of standard idea that I talk about every year in my astrobiology class, right? There's like a textbook's written about it. Water is a good solvent, might be the best solvent, but there certainly are other possibilities for solvents. And people talk about this all the time. It's not some fringe idea that would get you put on the outskirts of academia.
Yeah. Well, before we go on to the science shine, is there anything else you'd like to hit here?
So just one thing, because there's this beautiful image of Tau Ceti E, otherwise known as Adrian, in the movie. Honestly, gorgeous visual effects. But the colors are all wrong, unfortunately, because they show us what appear to be aurora. So aurora are these beautiful lights. Hopefully you've had a chance to see them. I honestly have never seen a good showing of aurora. I'm very disappointed. This is like on my bucket list. But it's where the magnetic field lines of Earth interact with the atmosphere and excite the molecules in it, primarily oxygen and nitrogen, to produce these beautiful colors, reds and greens and blues and so forth. And it appears that Adrian has these aurora as well. But it's unclear how that would work, because I guess they don't say this in the movie, but in the book, they clarify that Adrian is made of carbon dioxide. Obviously, that's why the Petrova line is there. Methane, okay. You don't usually see CO2 and methane together. And then argon. But none of these have auroral emissions in the visible range. They all appear to be in the infrared. So outside of where humans can see, we wouldn't be able to see it. Even argon, which is just a little bit past where humans can see, we can see out to about 700 nanometers, which we would call red. So it'd be really, really hard to see auroral emissions on a planet with this sort of atmospheric composition. Unlike on Earth, where oxygen and nitrogen are able to produce auroral emissions that we can see. Famously, Adrian has no nitrogen because it's deadly to these Tomiba, and there's no indication it has oxygen either. So as beautiful as the scene was, it seems a little bit unrealistic, unfortunately.
And there's that question of whether or not the astrophage are going to be attracted to the poles of Adrian versus mm-hmm. The sort of the equator, where you'd expect that CO2 line would be stronger.
Or just everywhere, right? There's CO2 everywhere. Yeah, yeah. Why aren't they just all over the planet?
Many questions. This movie raises many questions. But there are some things that we like. So we'll be right back in just a minute with the Science Shine. Welcome back, everybody. So now we're going to talk about the things that we really enjoyed about this movie. And you know us, when there's numbers, we just can't help ourselves. And Andy Weir likes to give us numbers. So prepare yourself for a little bit of math and checking his workings to see if the things are good. And I think the place you started with this, Catherine, was the dimming of the sun.
Yes. So this whole idea is that the astrophage are basically absorbing the energy from the sun and causing it to dim. So it's not that they're technically eating the sun, as some people like to say. It's just that they're absorbing the energy from the sun so that it dims before it makes its way to Earth. I don't think they give us a number in the movie, but in the book, they say, oh, the sun is going to dim by 10% in 30 years, roughly. Now, okay, this is a bit of a MacGuffin again, but apparently astrophage basically can turn all their mass directly into energy using the famous equation E equals mc squared. So you just stick their mass in, multiply it by the speed of light times 2, and you'll get their energy. So I did this, assuming that astrophage has a similar mass to E. coli. I don't know. I didn't really know where else to go. E. coli is a bacteria. Astrophage is another single cellular organism. And that's 10 to the negative 15th kilograms. So very, very small. Okay. So then you take the luminosity of the sun, which is a huge number. It puts out, I don't even know how to say this number, 4 times 10 to the 26th joules per second. That's a huge number. And then I figured out, well, okay, if the astrophage, the mass turned directly into energy, how much would you need? Turns out it's 4 times 10 to the 7th kilograms per second, which is also a ton. And so you'd need, like, I don't even know what number this is, 10 to the 23 astrophage per second. That's a ton of astrophage, right? But as we talked about in our Star Trek podcast, right, with the Tribbles, organisms can breed really quickly and quickly take over a star like our sun. I actually did the exponential growth calculation. If you're going to dim by that much, you need to breed about every 4 months, the astrophage. In the movie, they say it's an 8-day doubling time under optimal conditions, so it's a little bit off, but theoretically, you could produce a lot of astrophage very quickly. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I don't know what would stop them from growing, right, and going beyond this 10% number, but certainly you could get to that 10% number in 30 years if they doubled every about 4 months. So I worked that out, and it's not terribly unreasonable, other than the MacGuffin that they use all of their mass into energy. But beyond that, right, it's not out there. What did you think of this, John? I feel like I'm just sort of putting out way too many numbers here.
Well, I think the main take home here is that biological systems can replicate very quickly.
Yes.
And especially biological systems that are taking advantage of a new environment without predators and boundless energy. You know, this is the gray goo problem, the idea that if you had such a creature, it could just like multiply and consume the resources of everything everywhere. And I've got to say, Astrophage has one big advantage over a lot of other ecosystems in the sense that it's able to move close to the speed of light and its predator is not able to move at all. So the predator, you know, that Taumiba, it relies on these lone geniuses from other star systems to come and collect it and to bring it out there. This, I think, is kind of the challenge. Astrophage is almost too well designed in some ways. It's a dangerous organism.
Yes.
You know, not just, of course, to our star system, but to lots of them. That's interesting. You know, we've engineered in this story something that's almost like too good. And the sort of thing that, I mean, I don't know, like even if you save the Earth, where do you go from there? Because this is going to like turn off the night sky in decades.
Yeah, that's a great point, right? Like we wouldn't be able to see any of the closest stars to us. And then it would just keep expanding and expanding and could kill all the stars in our galaxy. Yeah, it's crazy. Luckily, like we said, this is physically plausible, so nothing like Astrophage will ever come to pass. But yeah, unchecked with no predators and infinite resources, these things could do a lot of damage.
Oh, absolutely. They do, I will say, cover the things like the speed of light well in the movie, though.
Yes.
I think one thing that you pointed out that I think I saw as well was the idea that Ryland Grace doesn't seem to age very much, whereas the people back on Earth, when they cut back to them afterwards, have visibly aged. And that's something that you see when you travel close to the speed of light, you experience sort of this time passing more slowly kind of event, this time dilation, essentially. And what that means is that if you had twins and one of them went off at the speed of light, came back, that twin would be much younger than the one who stayed on the Earth. And you can measure this with things like atomic clocks as well. Even for the kind of space travel we have now, you can add a couple seconds or fractions of a second to your life if you travel aboard the space station for a long period of time. So that was nice, I think.
Yeah, I think they did that experiment with a pair of twins, right? Mark and Scott Kelly, both of whom are astronauts. One was up on the space station, the other was back on Earth, and they monitored the two to see how they differed. That was kind of a fun experiment. So yeah, I mean, we can't go anywhere close to the speed of light. You do have to be like close to the speed of light for this to be reasonable. And you know, at most we go at a fraction of the speed of light. So it's not really an observable thing other than a few like milliseconds. I don't actually know how long it would be, but nothing like the years here that we see in this movie. But theoretically, if you could go that fast, yes, you would get time dilation. You would age a lot slower than the people back on Earth.
So another thing I thought was kind of fun and actually dealt with fairly well is the Eridanians, Rockies people. They make a lot of fundamental mistakes about traveling through space, you know, not realizing radiation and whatnot. And I enjoyed that, you know, we learned fairly quickly that Rocky's sensorium is very different than ours. And we know that when we go outside of the things we have natural experience with, that's when we tend to make these kinds of mistakes. It's really fascinating, you know, because he's somebody who echolocates, right? And that is how they're able to see things and communicate. You know, space is almost like this just big nothingness. In fact, I thought in my own mind when this first showed up, well, how did they even know there is a problem with their sun?
Yeah.
And I'm guessing it's just, you know, you notice the temperature dip. And so very rapidly, the Eridanians are probably required to go and travel into a whole scientific area that I would imagine has probably been a bit neglected for them.
Well, yeah. Could you even construct a space program when you didn't even know that space existed until, you know, shortly prior to this? That begs a little bit of disbelief, right? Because presumably, if you've never seen the stars, why would you even want to go into space, right? What would push you there, right? So now they're
exactly
building up a space program from absolutely nothing, and then sending a ship off to Tau Ceti. That's got to be really hard. And mind you, like they did make a lot of mistakes, but still, you would think it would take more than a couple of years to do this. And Rocky's already been there in that system for a while. So they detected this prior to the humans. Maybe the Astrophage got to Eridani before it got to the sun. I don't know. But I thought that was, it's something interesting to think about, right? Like, would we have gone to space if we couldn't see the stars? I don't know.
Exactly. Like, this is something that comes up when people talk about life on icy moons in particular, you know, which have like a solid cap on the livable volume there. If you do create creatures there who are sentient, intelligent, who have consciousness, do they have any reason to imagine there's something outside of their world, leaving aside the difficulties of creating tools in a fluid environment like that? So this is another interesting representation of that. Creatures that aren't bounded by something like that, but whose sensorium doesn't really allow them to capture that information.
Yeah. Anyways, I liked how they, looked at a different form of communication using sound instead of light, and how he even had to like design special instruments in order to read Grace's screens. It's an interesting way of looking at how you could approach communication in a different way.
And of course, the five tones. We've got to have a Close Encounter reference every episode this season.
I was the only person who laughed in the theater when they did the da 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 da. But I am, was also probably one of the oldest people there. And so I imagine a lot of people have not seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I appreciated that. So thank you. So do you want to talk about the stars too? Tau Ceti and Eridani?
This I haven't looked at so closely, so if you want to lead.
Sure. So they do make a point of these two different star systems. They go to Tau Ceti, which is a G-type star, not unlike the Sun, and it is about 12 light years away. That's good. And then 40 Eridani A is another star that's just a little bit more dim than our Sun. This is a real star. They're both real stars. What isn't so clear is whether or not there are planets around them, though. I think when Andy Weir first wrote this book, there was more evidence for planets around, especially Tau Ceti. But now it appears that the existence of this planet is doubtful. So exoplanets are planets that orbit other suns. We've been looking for them for, in earnest, I would say the past 25 years. It's a relatively new science. And there have been a number of telescopes. We talked about TESS in a previous, and Kepler in previous podcasts. But there are different techniques you can use to find exoplanets. And so people have been looking for them, especially around nearby stars like Tau Ceti and 40 Eridani. And Tau Ceti has four planet candidates, some of which are on the edge of the habitable zone. So the habitable zone is this region around a star where liquid water is stable at the surface. You can quibble about whether that's a great definition for a habitable zone, but people often use it as a metric of whether or not something could be Earth-like. And so there's this thought that there was this planet on the inner edge of Tau Ceti's habitable zone, which Weir uses as Adrian in his book. And they've been looking for it and some indication that it was there, but now they've had a spectrograph that should be able to detect it, look for it, and it wasn't there. So it's kind of doubtful whether it exists. I do love Rocky's comment, though, about the exoplanet names. He goes, planet is just name of star plus E. Boring. And I know a lot of exoplanetary scientists also agree with this. We don't get to name exoplanets like we do the planets in our own solar system. Perhaps because there's just too many of them and it would get confusing, but that's right. It's just planet is just name of star plus a letter. That's how we name planets, and that's true. But this planet,
it is unfortunate.
Yeah. But would you want to memorize thousands of names? I don't.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting human thing, right? Because it doesn't speak to us in quite the same way. And I know that when we're on other planets, we name like every rock and every feature, and we give them names so that we can work with them in our studies. But the poor exoplanetary people who have to remember this kind of gobbledygook, and in some cases, with some of these telescopes, like the stars actually just have numerical designations as well, like the asteroids we explored a few episodes ago.
Yeah. So Tau Ceti and 40 Eridani are actually great names, like oftentimes like HD640157B, and that's the planet. So hard to remember. So props to the exoplanetary scientists who have to remember all these names. In terms of Eridani, where Rocky is from, there does not appear to be a planet there. There was one proposed, but it seemed like it was too big and too close to the star, and it's probably just some sort of influence from stellar activity rather than a real signal. So as far as we know, Eridani doesn't have any planets. Although, fun fact, 40 Eridani A is supposed to be the Vulcan homeworld in Star Trek. So no Vulcans or Rockies out there, sadly.
Oh, no.
I know. We'll keep looking. You know, like these exoplanet surveys are sensitive to mass and size. So we don't tend to detect the smaller planets. Even something Earth size is still really hard to detect. So there could be smaller planets around these stars that we just haven't been able to detect yet, or planets that are further from their stars and not in the habitable zone, which could still, as John was saying, could still be habitable, you know, if you had subsurface life. So, you know, all hope is not lost, but these are real stars. that may or may not have planets that are near to us. So that all checks out. And time will tell whether or not they have any planets that could stand in for Arid or Adrian.
I think it's worth emphasizing here that the way that we discover these planets is we're looking in very noisy signals.
Yes.
And we're looking for little small statistical changes in there. And I think sometimes that's not really shared. That's glossed over a little bit because you just see the press release with a beautiful painting of what that planet might be and is probably not. And that can be a discovery that the next more sensitive spectrograph or telescope can determine actually doesn't exist at all. So it's kind of interesting. I wonder how that plays a little bit with the public, the idea that, you know, oh, there's a planet. Oh, no, there's not. And they sort of, you know, froth in and out of existence a little bit.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing about science, right? When you're learning mm-hmm. science in elementary school, it's presented as a set of facts. But that's not how science works, right? We're constantly revising our knowledge based on new observations, new data. So it's just a hypothesis, right? We have this idea, and then we're refining that idea as we get more and more data. And so science is not a fixed construct, right? It does change over time as we learn new things. And you don't really learn that until you get all the way up to graduate school. And most people are not doing graduate studies in science. So to the general public, they're still stuck back in elementary school days when science is just a set of facts. So it's something that's kind of hard to impress upon someone who hasn't been immersed in science like we have. But it's actually one of my favorite things about it, right? That we're constantly learning new stuff. I love that about science, right?
Oh, yes.
The chance to learn new knowledge. It's great.
It's fun. And the idea that it's tentative, right? I love that myself. The one thing I think that the movie does get right is that sometimes, you know, even though scientists are collaborative and when we are our best selves, you know, we're able to debate and critique things, we can be cruel too, right? Like there are theories out there, maybe not life with water, you know, as was presented here, but there are definitely theories that people hold on to for very human reasons for long periods mm-hmm. of time. And there is a saying in science that science advances through the deaths of older scientists who are holding on to those theories, and then the new ones can come in. And there is that aspect about it as well. There's that tension there.
Yeah. As a scientist, you always hope that when you're presented with new evidence, you would change your mind if the evidence supports it. But we're human, right? We have emotional responses. If we come up with an idea that we really like, even if new evidence is presented that disagrees with it, we might still hold on to it for emotional reasons. And that's natural, and it's often pretty common in science. So that's not unusual in this field. You know, the best of us hopefully will change our minds. But you know, we're also human.
Absolutely. So one last thing I think to talk about is that the climate change business, they actually do a decent job with this. So if you do go ahead and dial down the sun a little bit, you are going to see effects of that on the Earth. And with that 10% decrease, you're talking about, you know, about 6 degrees Kelvin, 6 degrees Celsius, 10 degrees Fahrenheit, at least at the top of the atmosphere. And the claim that it'll cool the Earth by 10 or 15 degrees Fahrenheit is right in that sweet spot, which I think is very well done. We do have this history on the Earth of having changing amounts of sunlight over time. The sun actually gets brighter over time. So in the distant past, we have the faint young sun, as it is called, which was about 25% dimmer than it is today. And in fact, the sun is going to keep getting brighter over time. It's thought that the Earth might not actually be habitable, at least not to the kinds of organisms that we know and love, in maybe a billion years or so, as the sun's output increases. So I liked this part of it. And I think you were a fan of this bit as well, weren't you, Catherine?
Yes. No, I thought they did a reasonable job with that, with the numbers that they presented. There's actually a whole section in the book and in the movie that got cut out where they actually blow up some glaciers in Antarctica to try to release methane, because methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So even if the sun's luminosity is dimming, if you put in more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, it can keep it warmer for longer and kind of hopefully mitigate some of these problems with climate change. And methane's actually great because it's a better greenhouse greenhouse gas than many others, and it also gets destroyed really rapidly by the sun. So you could stick it up in there in the atmosphere for a couple of decades, it would warm up the Earth, and then hopefully when they find a solution to this problem, it would then disappear and you could go back to the status quo. So certainly this is something to think about. I think it's fine that they took that scene out. I don't really need to see Antarctica getting bombed, but I guess Andy Weir, that was the one scene that he wanted to leave in that they weren't able to make room for.
Oh, interesting. Well, why don't we stop it there and we'll go on to the Of Its Time section and we can have our Andy Weir chat.
All right.
So we'll be back in a minute.
Okay, welcome back. So this time, our Of Its Time section is right now. This book was written in 2021. This movie was filmed in 2024. And as of recording, this came out in theaters a month ago. So this is not something that's decades in the past. It's Of Its Time is right now. So this makes it a little bit more difficult to talk about, but I think we've still got some content here, especially since this was clearly written by someone who's a Gen Xer. It was played by characters who are Gen Xers, and that really, I think, had an influence on the film in a way that was maybe lost on some of the younger viewers. Did you notice that, John?
Oh, yeah, there are references here. Like I think I noticed at one point that Ryland Grace is wearing a Cats t-shirt, and I remember, you know, how, like, I'm not a Gen Xer myself, but I'm very close to one. So I can see those sorts of like 80s and early 90s references, you know, scattered throughout. And you see this sort of stuff in the music and, you know, just the whole aesthetic.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like a lot of the music was from like the 60s and 70s. They had Beatles music when they launched those little probes called the Beatles. I thought that was fun. They had a song by Johnny Cash, a song by a tag team from 1993. Whoop, there it is, you know? So yeah, a lot of references there. Even you know, references to Eva Straat being in an East German's children's choir put it in the current time period, right?
It's expiring rapidly.
right. Because East Germany ceased to be in 1989. So, you know, you'd have to be pretty old to be in an East German children's choir. And I looked it up. It actually seems reasonable. The actress, Sandra Hüller, is indeed from East Germany. She was born in 1978. So she may as well have been in an East German children's choir. I don't know. She has a pretty good voice. So it wouldn't surprise me. It turns out that karaoke scene where she sings one of the more modern songs in this movie, Sign of the Times by Harry Styles, which I thought was a great scene. And apparently it came about because people just heard her kind of singing to herself on set and like were like, wow, you have a really good voice. And so they invented this scene. I thought it played out really well. It was very emotional and the song itself was very appropriate for the task they were undertaking. Lyrics like, remember everything will be all right. So yeah, I love that scene and it seemed like it all fit in with the timing here.
Oh yeah, they made a lot of hay out of that on Saturday Night Live because Ryan Gosling had a hosting opportunity there, and they actually had Harry Styles in the audience.
Oh, that's,
you know,
fun.
With that, the whole thing.
Another thing I thought was fun was the name of the movie, right? Project Hail Mary. You're like, where does this name come from? And it's pretty unique to North America, specifically the United States, this idea of a Hail Mary pass, right, in football, where you're just like, well, I've just got to chuck it and hope for the best, and, you know, we'll see what happens. But this is not a concept that necessarily translates very well to other countries, right? First of all, football is pretty much an American sport, right? You don't see people playing football, well, unless it's soccer, you know, anywhere else. And so I looked it up. I wanted to see what the name of this movie was in different countries. And I love some of the other names. My favorite is probably from Brazil. I'm going to butcher this, but it's like Devoradores de Estrelas, which is like devourers or eaters of stars, which a bit of a spoiler alert there in the name, but I love that one. Germans were very to the point. The Astronaut, I guess it's a sequel to The Martian in some ways, so just go straight to the point there. Hong Kong had Doomsday Holy Mothership, which is kind of a great name. Project Last
Chance. I
feel that
loses something in...
What's that?
It maybe loses something in translation. In translation, yeah.
Yeah, France had Project Last Chance, which also, I guess, was kind of their translation of Hail Mary. So yeah, kind of a fun collection of names from around the world for this movie.
Yeah, like there's just so many little fascinating things I think here. I appreciated they had the puppeteering with Rocky as well. Like that adds a certain fluidity that we don't see so much these days. More of these sort of like practical effects as you've seen. And yeah, just really interesting things. I mean, you know, we'll talk about Andy Weir in a minute, but clearly his reputation preceded him. He was able to option this one before the book even came out. It was a little bit, it reminded me a little bit of Jurassic Park that way, actually.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
Something very, and, very fast.
And Ryan Gosling was in from the beginning too, right? Like, it's not like they had to convince him to get on board, you know, so you have this huge star. I think he was famous, right, in 2020, and he's only become more famous in the last 6 years. So born in London, Ontario, our own hometown guy, not that he's ever been here since he was born, but, you know, just a little call out to our hometown hero. We had actually two astronauts from London, Ontario that week. We had Ryan Gosling playing a fake astronaut, and then, of course, Jeremy Hansen, the actual astronaut, going to the moon, also from just outside London. So, you know, despite being a town that no one has ever heard of, we do have our fair share of astronauts.
What's in the water there, Catherine?
Apparently xenonite. I don't know.
Yeah, that might just do it.
Yeah.
It's not surprising, though, that it got, I think, snapped up so quickly. When you think about the Martian, which was a huge hit, and for Ridley Scott, like, for that to be his biggest movie ever is, like, you would not pick that out of his oeuvre. So this was something, like, maybe not a sure thing, but, you know, I see the appeal.
And it's done well, right? As of this taping, it's made almost $600 million as the third grossing film of 2026 behind Super Mario Brothers Galaxy Movie, which I've also seen. I gotta say, though, I like Project Hail Mary better. So no offense to Super Mario Brothers, but...
And I have seen, you know, like in the informal and anecdotal poll of my graduate students who are getting younger and younger compared to us,
that's
Catherine,
true.
I'm sorry.
That's true.
They love this one too. So there's some cross-generational appeal there.
For sure. And yeah, I thought all the acting was really good. I thought Gosling really nailed it. But I was especially impressed by Rocky. I didn't know what to expect there, but James Ortiz, who was the puppeteer and also voiced Rocky, did a great job. They originally thought they might replace his voice with a more famous actor, hence that scene where they go through all the different options. But in the end, they're like, no, this can't be improved upon. We're gonna run with your voice. Apparently, that scene, though, where Ryan Gosling's like, can we get Meryl Streep to voice Rocky? And he just kind of said that as a throwaway line. But they approached her and she did that little cameo there, which I thought was pretty fun. Can you imagine Rocky rolling around the Hail Mary talking like Meryl Streep?
Hey, like they said, she can do anything. Something that I thought was interesting with the production design, and you mentioned the whole Gen X thing, is that it felt like throwback.
Yeah,
right?
a little bit.
So many physical buttons. You know, we don't even design spacecraft that way today, right? Like if you look at the new Dragon capsules and, you know, the new spacecraft that are getting put out there, even aircraft as well, getting more and more screen-based. So it was interesting to see something that felt more 80s, 90s-ish.
Yeah, kind of like the space shuttle, right? Which was a very, you know, a staple of the 80s and 90s. So yeah, and I love the love for the geek throughout. Like in addition to the cat t-shirt, he had all these fun nerdy shirts apparently also available with this mass budget that the Hail Mary had. One said, I had potential, you know, implying like, so gravitational potential is something you have if you're up at high and then you roll down a hill. And then he had one with a periodic table on it that said, I wear this shirt periodically. Anyway, so some fun nerd call outs there. These are things that a scientist might actually wear. Although again, when I was watching the Artemis mission, they all just wore the same like kind of uniform every day. It's not like they brought their own fun t-shirts to wear. Sadly, that would have been nice.
It's true. Definitely less copies of, you know, polos with embroidered patches than we normally
see. Yeah, although
see.
They did have the Project Hail Mary hat and t-shirts, I noticed, too. He says to Strut, did you get the free hat? She's like, I bought the hats. And it's cool, right? I love the character of Strahd, actually. I thought she did a great job, too.
Oh, yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, she's a German actress that doesn't actually do much work in American film. So she's kind of, I think, a new face to a lot of us, but very famous in Germany. And I thought she really nailed that part. And it was so cool to see, you know, somebody just like taking charge and bringing the world together to fight a known threat, which is something we're desperately in need of these days, right? We have so many existential crises on Earth facing humans, and nobody seems to care about it. And here we have this character who's just so devoted to saving the world. You know, she will do everything, anything in her power to save the world, including like pissing people off, breaking laws, drugging Ryan Gosling and throwing him on a spaceship, right? Because she wants to save the world. And that's, I don't know, I like that idea. I like that character. I wish we had more people like that. And so in a way, this was very much an allegory for climate change and how we're not doing any of this to fight what is not a cooling of the world, but a warming of the world.
Indeed. But I think we're at the time, Catherine.
Yep.
Andy doesn't believe it's about climate change.
Yes. He is baffling. I call him the biggest of bros, right? He's of this type of engineer, because that's his background, right? It's like computer engineering before he became an author, where they just think that math is disconnected from society. Between the two podcasts on The Martian and this one, Project Hail Mary came out, and he started talking to reporters and saying some really questionable things that got me pretty concerned. So here's one of the quotes. Actually, I think this might be from an earlier article. I don't know if this is a recent article or from the past, but he said, "I dislike social commentary. Like, I really hate it. When I'm reading a book, I just want to be entertained, not preached at by the author. It ruins the wonder of the story if I know the author has a political or social axe to grind. I no longer speculate about all possible outcomes of the story because I know for a fact that the universe of that book will conspire to ensure the author's political agenda is validated. I hate that." But meanwhile, he's writing this book, which is clearly an allegory for climate change. Authors are not like shielded from the world around them.
Yeah.
Right? They exist in society. Society influences them, even if they don't realize it. And it's weird that he's not acknowledging that.
Well, it's impossible to write a book or to make a movie that is completely antiseptic and is completely divorced, as you say, from any kind of social background, societal background. You know, there's no way to take absolutely no point of view. But at the same time, this is something we encounter in our professional lives as well, in science and in engineering, the idea that we don't need to deal with the things that are not going well in society, with the troubles and all that, because, you know, we're just doing the math here. And the math is the math, no matter who's doing it or in what context they're doing it. But those things matter, right? And if you're going to create a story which has a human element to it, that can't be divorced. And it isn't divorced. As you say, you know, there are things in here that are very clearly, you know, whether or not Andy Weir intended them to be, very good allegories for things happening in the world.
And it's fundamentally a story about friendship between two very different people, right? It just shows you the benefits of having diverse people, or rocks in this case, working together to solve a problem. But everything he says, you know, in these interviews seems to suggest that he doesn't understand that. He also claims to be a Star Trek fan without really understanding the point of Star Trek, you know? Here's another quote. "For instance, as a lifelong Star Trek fan, it's always bothered me that there is presumed responsibility within Star Trek shows to talk about social issues. I just want to watch Romulans and the Federation shoot at each other." So clearly he's never watched Star Trek if that's what he thinks it's about, right? Like, it's about different species working together for the greater good. It's about socialism and the utility of all humans to contribute to society, regardless of what their background is. Anyways, I think it's bizarre that he doesn't seem to understand this.
It is a little strange, right? Like the way that he describes it, the types of things that he enjoys. Apologies to our Star Wars fans listeners out there. It seems a little bit more like the types of things that are emphasized in that, you know, like let's fly through the canyon and blast at one another. Whereas if you go back to like, especially the original Star Trek, like those were designed as allegories and then they were hard to miss, you know, exactly what was happening there. And those were stories, and it continued on, you know, in subsequent series that were slower because there was time given over to discussion and to grappling with things and conversations between characters in a way that is different from the kind of science fiction that he's talking about.
Right. So I don't know. All this discussion really makes me not want to read his future novels, to be honest. Like I said, I've always had issues with the novels just because of their over-reliance on math and their under-reliance on character development. But seeing where he's coming from makes me worry about any future works he were to write and not really make me want to read them.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. Hopefully there can be more good collaborations like these where Andy brings an interesting and fun idea and he brings the math, and then, you know, Miller and Lord and
Ridley
Gosling,
Scott, or
exactly. Yeah. They bring the emotion and the humanity.
Bring it to life. All right. Well, we'll see. All right. I'll just stick to the movies then and not read the books, which is not usually a thing you hear. Because typically the books are better than the movies, but not in this case. All right. Well, shall we wrap things up, John, and head off to our next section where we rate the movie?
Sounds good.
All right, so this is our final segment of Popcorn Science, where we rate the movie in three categories in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how it holds up over time. I struggled with this section. John, I see you gave it numbers, but I honestly had no idea what to give it for influence and how does it hold up. So why don't we start with scientific accuracy? Because that I can comment on.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I gave this one a 4. I think there are things here that are problems, but at the same time, it's not just bonkers, right? Like, there are fun ideas that we can play with here. So, you know, I don't think it's perfect on the science, but it gets enough right that this is a movie that is a good advocate for science and science in movies. So I'm giving it a 4.
I judged it a little bit harsher than you, 3.5. I hadn't really appreciated how many MacGuffins are really in this movie. Like I said, I think The Martian is more realistic than this. To be fair, though, I think the book did a better job with the science. It just didn't come through in the movie, which, like I mentioned earlier, I'm not mad at, right? I don't want to be lectured at, you know, with different physics and math problems throughout the movie. But there are things they just sort of hand-waved away. The astrophage, the xenonite, the coma, you know, there's just a lot there that didn't really get well explained. So I can't give it great marks as a result. All right. So, John, you actually gave this a number for influence. How did you come up with that number?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because we're projecting here a little bit. And you know, it may seem silly to give a number, but I feel like we've seen enough of these now and we've talked about, you and I, enough of these now that I'm kind of starting, maybe I'm just hallucinating, but I'm kind of starting to see the markers of things that are going to hold up over time. So first of all, you know, in the moment, this is something that, you know, is part of the conversation. I mean, our students are seeing it, friends are seeing it, $600 million worth of people have gone to see it. So it's something that's in the conversation. Now, it's also March and April. The tentpole season is not upon us yet. There will be things that outshine this. You already mentioned there's been the Mario Brothers movie. And so I feel like this is something that is going to be part of the conversation, but maybe it's not going to dominate it. It's well made in the way that other movies we've seen in the past have been well made, but it's also not sort of blowing me away in terms of something that I've never seen before. It's not a 2001, I don't think, in quite the same way. So I feel like this is something that is going to stay in the conversation, but not dominate it. The way that we still talk about The Martian, but only for a couple of things, not sort of writ large. So that's my hand wavy 3 rating for this one, right down the middle.
I'm still going to give it a not applicable, but I agree with you, John. I don't see this as a movie that's going to make a lasting impact on society. You know, it was a fun popcorn flip to see, but it's not really going to sit with us for a long time. I think I saw somebody mention that they thought it was the best sci-fi movie in the last decade. And I was like, that can't be right. But then I looked it up and there honestly haven't been a lot of sci-fi movies in the last decade. For some reason, this genre is just not as popular as it once was. I think we talked about this before, you know, how popular aliens were in the 90s. And it just doesn't seem to be the same emphasis on this sort of type of movie anymore. So, you know, it very well could be one of the best sci-fi movies of the last decade. But that being said, there aren't a lot to choose from either. So it's unclear how influential this will be going forward.
Yeah, people are just dreaming in different ways right now, it seems to me.
Yeah, and fair enough. Culture changes over time, as much as Andy Weir would not like to admit that. and here we are. So I watched this movie a month ago. How does it hold up in that month, John?
Yeah, I watched it like a week and a half ago. I feel like there's a lot of care that was taken in this one, right? The things that were done were done well, and they were intentionally done in a way to make it so that they'll have some longevity. Like we talked about Rocky and not doing that digitally. It could so easily have been done digitally. There's so many corners that could have been cut. And that's not what happened here. So that strikes me as a marker of something that if you come back to it in a couple of decades, this will still look good in the way that some of the things that we've looked at from the 80s and the 90s and 70s maybe haven't, you know, really looked all that great. So I feel confident that this one is going to hold up at the level of about a 4.
All right. I still will withhold my judgment, but I did like the emphasis on practical effects. I notice when you go back and you watch the movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s that, you know, lean into the practical effects, they look really good. They still do. Like even Star Wars, which is 50 years old, right? All those practical effects look amazing. Whereas some of the early CGI looks just terrible. And so I think if you lean into the practical effects, it's going to hold up better than CGI, which could certainly change over the next few decades in terms of quality. So yeah, I'm not going to give it a number because I don't have my crystal ball with me here, but I agree that I think this one might hold up better than others.
Well, you're welcome to borrow my crystal ball anytime you need.
Excellent. Thank you. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
Well, I just want to thank all of our listeners out there for joining us this week. And while we can't wait to talk to you again, for now, it's time go statement. Amaze, amaze. Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.